Hello, this is Jay Nemro. You're listening to The Life Autistic. This is episode number 674. And this is Navigium. And that is the title of my great magnus opus I've been working on in various forms, in various ways, since I was about, 15, 16, maybe 14 years old. And kind of an on-again, off-again thing. And taken a lot of forms over the years. And met with much more failure than success. I can be really honest in telling you that my writing career, at least fiction writing, has been a farce. Except for, I have been published. I'll tell you that publishing has happened. And not just by me. This is not just self-publishing, vanity press stuff. Other people have published my work. And so I know I'm not just an absolute zero when it comes to writing, but haven't made penny one from fiction writing. Other kinds of writing? I've done a bit better. I haven't gotten a job specifically as a writer, but, honestly, I never really pursued that particularly. It's always been kind of an aspect of what I did. And that was at least helpful. I can't speak to anything else in particular about my writing, except to say that it's there, however it manifests itself, that's what it is. Navigium is the next, is my work since, the working title of Godsend has kind of gone away. Navigium's kind of picked up where it left off with some changes. I have integrated some of my other work into it to try to make it work better. I think I already talked about this in an episode, not too much in the past, about the Mariner Code, the Mariner's Log, and things like that. So I'm not going to go into that. I'm going to go more into the mechanics of how I plan to do it this time around. And hopefully be a little more organic about it. I think the problem is I was trying to structure it too much, and when I felt like it wasn't going in the right direction, I'd stop, and then I'd begin again. And I need to stop doing that, of course. So I decided I'm going to make it into a serial, and it's going to go out over the internet. Now, I'm not going to totally walk away from the possibility that someday it will, that this work will manifest itself as will manifest itself as a book, as something that's published and, and has a publisher and stuff like that. But, I'll let that kind of happen if it happens. I'm not going to kill myself pursuing it. This is going to be more like the old-time serials, I guess back in the days of Charles Dickens or Edgar Rice Burroughs or... I haven't read very much the serials, but that's kind of... I think that works better in the in the medium of the internet, especially the World Wide Web, trying to put it out on like a web page, I think it's much more amenable to that. I know there used to be an ebook. I wouldn't say craze. People got this idea that ebooks would sell really well, and they tried, and it failed miserably. Basically, it's still there. There's still some things that are produced as ebooks, but by and large, no. Because people don't like reading from a screen. At least not for long periods, and not a whole novel, not a whole thick book. So, my whole thought is to break this thing up and make it into more of a serial and do it that way. You know, people have gotten into series now. They like having a series of books. It used to be the trilogy, and it's kind of grown beyond trilogies, honestly. So, it's almost like we're getting back to the series in a way anyway, although they tend to be larger. Mine isn't. Mine's going to be some of the smaller side. Kind of more of a chapter book, or a chapter side. I want to say chapter book. Makes it sound like something for elementary school kids. It gives you this capability to just, you know, do this stuff without, so it means itself to to the internet a little bit more than normal, I think. Since I have been doing this kind of in an organic way anyway, just kind of seeing how it goes. I mean, I have a basic outline that I know where the story is ultimately going to go. I just don't know how I'm going to get there particularly. That as it organically unfolds, I think that could be interesting. And I think it's novel enough that it might create a little bit of buzz, which it needs, especially when you're doing it yourself and you're just putting it up on the internet and you're not really advertising it, you know, you're not really marketing it heavily. It's going to be very much good about letting other people discover it and spread the word about it and not having me try to do it. Because I really stink at that, so I'll let that go. Godsend was taking a few, you know, now this isn't like Godsend ended and the Navigium began. What it's really coming down to is kind of an organic thing. Some elements are new. Some are resurrected from back in the past a ways. Whatever seems to fit what needs to happen is kind of what's happening. This podcast is even kind of coming in. Not just as a way to try to get a little bit of an audience from the beginning, but just to say, but that I've decided that this is really going to be kind of a Zenith book, a book written by a Zenith. You know, it's pretty easy for me since I get to define what Zenith is. But you know, it's. And I'm going to let it be a lot of me. I'm not going to do a lot of things. Well, I need to say it this way because this is the way they'd say it in other books. I'm going to try really hard, or at least try to let go of that really hard. I guess, you know, it's kind of a weird effort is to say, don't sit there and don't analyze it too hard. Just kind of let it flow, Jay. Let it flow. So, that's probably going to be my biggest effort is just not to not to edit heavily, because that's what's always killed it in the past, is that I go back and I go, I don't like where this is going, and I'd kill it. I'd start over again. I've probably got 500 versions of the first 5 chapters of what is now becoming Navigium. And, you know, I feel like there's this log jam and I've got to break it. And the way I'm going to break it is I'm just not going to sit there and try to make it all orderly and try to make it almost marketable to me. I have at times thrown away marketability, almost made kind of a weird thing for me to do, is to make it less marketable. Now, I'm not going to specifically do that anymore. I'm just not going to worry about it. We're not, and I don't plan immediately on talking about it, the fact that it's not marketable. So I wouldn't mind if all of a sudden it did get a little marketable. It wouldn't bother me in the least. I'd like it. Be able to sell a bit of it. Make it work out better. I think that would be wonderful. Anyway, so let me see. Talk about the organic. I don't even know if I really have a plan for what this thing is. I'm just talking about what's kind of in my head for this. But it's kind of written by a Zenith for Zenith. Now, I don't know if I'm going to do that particularly in particular. I think I will view my audience as being people like me, because I have had something of a journey in trying to find what makes me happy, or how I view myself in the larger scheme of things, and trying to figure out whether I'm, you know, whether I'm really useful. You know, so many people struggle with the whole fact of, why am I here? Why am I this way? I was on I guess I have to keep bringing up that autism chat room that I was on, which also helps color all this stuff, you know. How do you feel about this, that, and the other thing? How do you, what's your take on it? And some of their takes on God was really kind of upset. You know, how come God doesn't do things this way? How come God doesn't do things that way? You know, why did God make me this way? And just kind of anger and the angst. Now, I didn't hear that from everybody, just heard it from a few people. But that I find it really interesting. You know, I've always said that I felt like that atheism was kind of a living attack on the silliness of mainline Christianity's dogma, thought, their kind of worldview. Because I actually agree with atheists that most of what people, you know, that when people talk about God, they're talking about something that's silly and makes no sense. and that as Christians continue to promote these ideas and telling other people that you just have to take this on faith, and that we'll all understand it later, that God is smarter than we are, and it's like, well, no, this is just on its face, just bold-faced stupid, what you're saying. You know, God is this way, Christ is this way, and, you know, this is the way the whole system works, and you go, well, God. And I'm not saying that those who have studied really feel that way, you know, that God is some heartless, passionless, heartless kind of punishing figure that you really want to just kind of, you know, well, anyway, that it's like that. I want this book, I want Navigium, I call it a book, although it's not going to end up being that. It's going to end up being a story, you know, and you can chop it up any way you like. If you want to chop it into books, I suppose you can. But, But I envision this book most of all, and this has kind of grown into this over time. It isn't like also I made a decision, well, we're going to make this big, huge sea change in it. If there was any sea change that came in the direction and drive of the book, it happened kind of several years ago. But it's just, it's almost like as I continue to kind of poke at it and look at it and say, you know, what does all this mean? Where is this headed? That this kind of has revealed itself over time to be what this is all about. This book is almost kind of a restatement of a lot of things that I talked about on this podcast. I talk about in other settings. It's kind of a religious book without being terribly religious. It's kind of a book about why you are and how you came to be and where you fit in, but instead of taking kind of a religious stance on it, because religion asks you to what a lot of people call religion these days asks you to suspend reality, suspend what you see, suspend what your mind is telling you, and to believe in a fantasy. Or just to have blind faith in something that got cooked up one day. And boy, you have to have blind faith in all this stuff. And this thing kind of goes, hopefully, beyond that. Now, hopefully it'll be something that will be of interest not just to the Zenist community, but to others. Although I will write it, I think, in a way to kind of answer what I would consider to be Zenist arguments on this kind of thing. Kind of Asperger, ADHD, almost a refutation of our culture, but to look at it from the standpoint of a different culture that really isn't terribly similar to ours, but has some aspects the same. The culture that's predominant among the convocation of women, it's quite different from ours in almost kind of striking ways. But in other ways, they tend to use the same tactics. And when you take the tactics of our culture and society, at least in the United States, for instance, when you pull it out of context and you stick it somewhere else, it helps people to be able to see those aspects much more clearly. When it's right there in front of you and you live it every day, sometimes it's hard to see those things. You know, the whole idea of manipulation toward complacency. You know, our culture is really all about making people content with their lot, and that this is a tool both for, I don't know if I really want to say it's a tool for good, but it can also be used for evil to get you to just accept the way things have evolved, and that you don't try to actively work against it. And a whole lot of this book is the actions of people who see or come to understand that things are wrong, that things shouldn't be, or that things would be better if they were another way, I think is the better way to say it. And that you can actually make this happen. In fact, there's two or three ways that it gets done. The actual first book, just trying to give it some kind of a structure. The first book actually ends with our two main, well, the very first two protagonists that we have. Escaping this culture of the convocation. They actually do it by actually physically escaping. They get away from it. Now, later, they choose to come back, and it's a combination of things. It's a combination of how Melisandre feels about her older sister and wanting to save her. And also God touching Davor and giving him revelation that kind of helps put things into motion. God isn't going to let them just sit there away. They're going to have to be actors in a much greater. Much greater work. At the end of book one, you get the impression that, you know, this is just a nice story about the problems of culture and one way of handling it. And then all of a sudden you find out in book two that they aren't going to be allowed just to keep that state. And they're somewhat dissatisfied with it. Or at least Mishiana is. Or Melisandre, sorry. Melisandre is very unhappy with her circumstances because there were some parts of the convocation that she liked very much, and when she abandoned those things too. And so she's kind of drawn back to that stuff. And what we come to find out is that given the fact that she's walked away from it, that she's gotten she's had other experiences in her life, we come to find out that this makes her even more of a powerful person, a convocation. Now, powerful people are a two-edged sword in any situation, I think, but in the convocation especially. You know, you tend to rise well in the convocation, but you tend to threaten the powers that be. I think that's true of anything. I don't think that's specific to the convocation. But, you know, makes it so that it just certainly makes it interesting. Let me see. What else is there to say here? I don't want to get much too into the details of it, although, you know, I'm sure as I'm working on it, I'll have insights that come from it. That I'll be talking about in these episodes, podcast episodes, as I continue to work on the Vigium, continue to explore the world of being Zenith, and how being Zenith, and this is the whole part of it, how being Zenith is purposeful and useful. And the next step that I've come to, that number one, God made you Zenith. If you are, you know, and whatever connotation you spin on that, autistic, Asperger's, ADHD, OCD, whatever. That there is a purpose in you being like this. And it's not just to give other people things to deal with, you know. It's not just, well, you're disabled and you're supposed to be touching people's hearts and lives and yada, yada, yada. And you go, no, you know, I think there's some deeper stuff here, especially when it comes to Zenith, because there's so many of them. And so many of them aren't, quote-unquote, disabled. You know, have difficulties living within the society and the culture that we've created. Certainly that's true. If there's anything that calls out for a new culture, calls out for almost a new way of being, it's that. I know I've talked a little bit in the past about maybe starting a reservation for these kind of people, but I don't think that's the purpose. If that was true, this thing would have risen up, I think, in a particular place. Not saying that someday we'll come closer together, you know. But I think it's important that Zenith is somewhat sprinkled among the larger world. Because I think we have work to do, and that it is a work of service to those whose world this is. I've been talking about this a little with my family. I think I'll do it a little bit more. The fact that our purpose is to not to alter this world to suit our needs, but to help people whose world this is. When I did my last Myers-Briggs personality test thing, and I actually tested out quite different. And then after I did that, I found out that a lot of autistic people type out this way. INTJ. Used to be an INFP. I think that was just what I thought I was supposed to be. And that's a hard thing. That's a difficult thing for a lot of Zeniths. I think it's something that Zenith people need to get past, is the whole idea that, you know, you're supposed to be shaping yourself to fit this world, and the world would really rather have people like you be this way, you know. And it's like, no, but I'm really this way. I think that's what came out in this last Myers-Briggs personality test, the INTJ one. And it really goes to, you have to it's important to be true to yourself, but understand that in doing that, you need to understand that, number one, you're different, and number two, you're not really supposed to be here to change the world to make it suit you more. That's somewhat of a selfish act. Zenas, the Zenoi, is really our visitors on this world. That's why we feel like strangers and foreigners and aliens. You know, we're quite different from the people who are here. But we are here. It wasn't because God made a mistake in processing. It wasn't because of anything like that. It was because people like us are needed. The fact that there are more Zenith people right now, and I don't know if that's true, I'm still willing to say that it's because it's kind of the diagnosis de jure right now, but I think it's interesting that all these, you know, this is our favorite diagnosis for probably in the last 20, almost 30 years, have been Zenith type diagnoses. And I'm starting to see that Zenith is more encompassing. It takes in more. Autism is an aspect of it. Asperger's is an aspect of it. ADHD, OT, OCD, all these things are, I think, really just kind of different flavors of being Zenith. Just like with normal people, some of them are, you know, dog people or cat people, or they're big into cars, and you can almost have conventions of those kinds of people, although they are quite normal. Same, I think, holds true with Zenith. You know, Zenith people form their own group analogous to being normal, in that within Zenith there's so much variation among the aliens that are here. If I can, I'll go ahead and say it. Now, I'm not writing this down as doctrine. It's just a thought I had once, and I'm not going to entertain it too terribly much because I don't think it's really important, ultimately, to religious concepts like salvation and exaltation and things like that. In Mormon thought, we have a heavenly father and mother. We are their spirit children. To a large degree, that relationship there is actually more, I don't want to say important, but it's probably more realistic to who we really are than the fact that you're born here on Earth to mortal parents. You know, ask any parent who's dealing with a difficult child from birth, and you can say, this child was like this from the very beginning. And you go, it isn't just that. They were like that before then, too. This is an essential part of their nature that existed before they were even born. Now, that's a pretty deep LDS concept. But let me go a little bit deeper and say that when I talk about Zenith people, essentially these aliens, these people that almost seem like they're prisoners in their own skin. It's almost like we really are something else, but God clothed us in these bodies to make us look like normal people, and it isn't a very good fit. The concept of having a heavenly father and mother, we don't usually talk about the mother aspect of it. It's usually always in relation to the father. You know, you talk about father. There's a God. We don't talk about anybody else particularly. I think it's because God doesn't just have one wife. there isn't just one Heavenly Mother of people here on earth. Now, I'm not saying that that's true. I don't know that. And because it is not vital to our ultimate progress through life to have this truth, you know, I don't picture it being preached from pulpits. I don't picture it being done like that. I'm not going to preach these kinds of things from the pulpit unless I get clearance to do so. Unless I feel like it's what God, Heavenly Father, you remember me talking about how I prefer looking at Him as Heavenly Father as opposed to God, because God's got so many weird, twisted up connotations to it. Heavenly Father is much better because it would make sense that I'm more like Heavenly, you know, that I'm like Heavenly Father. Because I'm His son. You are too. You know, I'm not trying to get all, well, I'm this big guy because I'm Heavenly Father's son. You go, no. We all are. But when it comes to these different people, these different Venus type people, people who really do feel like we were born the wrong planet. We're not from here. We just feel like we're kind of visitors. We're kind of sojourning here. I have pondered and said, well, you know the possibility? You know what the possibility is? We might be from a different Heavenly Mother than the NTs, than the normal people here on Earth. Even though they make up the vast majority of people. Although it doesn't, you know, I don't know what's statistical. I don't know what's right. I don't know if autism is being over-diagnosed, if people are just running toward it because it seems to be a nice, easy thing to slip people into. If you're weird or if you're hard to deal with, you used to be called ADHD. Now they tend to call you autistic. But I do think that it is a reference to having people that are essentially different. People that when you use what would normally be considered culturally appropriate tactics to get them to do what needs to be done, like school. School is wrapped in power issues. And school worked excellently 50 years ago. You might have had a few troublesome people, but they were that. They were just very, very few. Of course, that was in the days when you could get rid of troublesome people. You could convince them to leave, that they weren't supposed to be there. Now there's rules that say everybody has to go no matter what. And so tactics have been put into place to try to deal with these people. Of course, they're getting to be a larger and larger group of people who these cultural... I can't think of any other word to use but cultural tactics to use. You know, shame, shunning, ridicule, stuff like that. The kind of stuff that always used to work just fine, making people get into line and do what their betters want them to do. These things don't often work with Venus. They'll just continue right on being exactly the way they are. And if you apply it harder... You know, and I'm not saying that we can't bend and shape ourselves to try to fit in better, but we find more and more that there's plenty of people that don't have an interest in fitting in better. They don't want to do that. I may have been among a much smaller group of Zeniths that at least gave an effort to trying to fit in at some point in my life. I have to say that I've gotten to the point where I don't care much anymore. And I tend to fight institutions. You know, Jay's voice say, boy, Jay really hates school. And you go, no, I hate what school does to people. School is all about conforming. It's about being complicit, about compliance. There's a certain way things need to be. It's embedded in our culture. It has to do with being normal. And it also has to do with accepting things the way they are. You know, instead of being a rabble-rouser and trying to change things. the powers that be, and whatever those powers that be are, whether it's evil, which you could put into more of a religious term of Satan or the devil, or just powerful parties or people here in the flesh on earth, that want things to stay exactly the way they are, and that steer things in order to do that, whether they do it mindfully or whether it's just kind of, let's just keep everything easy, we want things to stay the way they are, let's make it that way. I was starting a little bit of an essay on being complicit, and that's what most people want, you know. We just want to fit in, you know, we just want to find our place and be okay. And as a Zenith, I find that dangerous, because in doing that, people like me lose their souls. And I don't want to lose my soul. I think there's good aspects about me, and that's what the whole book is about. The very first book of the story is very much about somebody who just can't seem to be very complicit. And that's Davor, and it's Melisandre too. And they find that they have to create their own reality in order to feel better within their skin. And I do envision these two people as being Zenith. And they have a child who is Zenith, even much more so than they are. Well, and since he has not been trained from childhood like his parents were to be complicit, he's able to do so much more than other people are willing to do, or even have the capability of doing. Getting out of complacency is sometimes very difficult. I find it difficult. And trying to avoid turtles. This is turtle season. The turtles are out, a whole bunch of them. Now that the rains, we haven't had much rain in the last a week or two, and although the rain kind of woke up turtleness, now they're moving around more because that's the money, I guess. Anyway, so all these things, you know, and the fact that God has, I think there is getting to be more Zenith people on the earth, because there's going to be something that Zenith will be able to contribute to. I think that basic idea of being obsessioned, having large obsessions. Now, I've always been talking about the fact that one can steer their obsessions. You can decide what you're going to be obsessed about within reason. I mean, you know, you can't just decide that you're obsessed about this thing and you're going to be obsessed about something else instead. I'm not sure you can really do that. But I think you can, to a degree. You can, like a rudder on a ship. It may not be a very big rudder, but that rudder can move the ship. It may not be able to move it in big grand waves exactly on a dime and exactly the way you want it to. But that rudder, you know, using that rudder, even though it may seem small compared to this huge ship of the way you are and the life that you lead, you can use it to at least steer it towards something positive, something good, which is always what I've been telling Zenith people that they needed to do. Take your attributes that you have. Don't go the complacency route and say, oh, no, I must look like everybody else, and I must work very hard to reject what I am and who I am. Because that's not useful. What you want to do, you know, is say, this is the way I am, but there's some good attributes to this. Obsession, when turned to good, is a very powerful force. And that's what happens in the course of this story. Wesslyn, who is the son of Melisenda and Davor, he is obsessed. He is obsessed with bringing back the Kiami culture to Aled. He has decided, and I think rightly so, and God has led him to this, he's decided that this is the most important thing. To be about. And so he covertly does this. You know, in the midst of the other things that he's had to do, which is totally destroy the convocation culture, there is something of a vacuum that he is a big instrumental part of having created. You know, he has been one of the instruments to the destruction, and it creates this kind of power vacuum which he's trying to, I don't know if he's trying to fill it, but he's trying to allow space for the Kiami culture to take root. And to do that, he has to destroy what was there before. It's almost like gardening or your yard or something. If weeds have taken over, you have to take out the weeds to allow the good things that you want to grow to grow. Now you have to understand that when you take out everything, bad stuff's going to sprout up too. I mean, you know, when you leave that ground open, all kinds of things are going to spring up. But it gives you the chance that things like the Kiami culture can also spring up and find a foothold, at least somewhere. So this is what ultimately happens. So our friend Wesslyn, the ultimate Zenith, well, I don't know if he's the ultimate Zenith. He is a Zenith. There really isn't an ultimate one. His mind is open. That's one of the things. That's something that Zenith can bring to the table if they're careful and if they have the right, if they're willing not to get weird about certain aspects of life. It's really easy for me to get weird about not liking school, but I have to get beyond that. And I have to say, okay, why do I have this problem with school? And it goes back to the whole thing about the conformity, about saying that you need to be a certain way, and that bothered me. And I try to help my kids avoid school because I don't want them to have to fight with the power of complacency in my life. I would rather my kids didn't have that kind of complacency, that they could get beyond it. And the way to do it, at least for me, was to get them further away from school than I could do. Now, my wife Lisa can only handle so much. She is a very compliant in certain ways she's not. She is much more invested in the way things are, that she's not willing to take too much steps out of there. I'm willing to go much further. I encourage my children to go way further than that when they can. I think my daughter Shane is still trying to get her feet under her and trust herself. She's really nervous, you know. And I think it has to do with just trying to fit in with culture. And you go, you know what? Ignore culture. Ignore culture, ignore culture. It isn't useful. So many times it actually draws us toward doing the wrong thing, having the wrong reaction to situations, pulling us further away from our goal of becoming like our Heavenly Father. It really does all that. Now, you guys might say, well, that's not my goal. And you go, well, it's what all this stuff is about. It's what all this stuff is about. It's about trying to become like Heavenly Father or Heavenly Mother in the case of women. But we don't talk about that. You know, focus is on Heavenly Father because that, I think, or at least I'm willing to see that that is the thing that we have in common. We may not have the same mothers. And it's really easy to always just take that next little step and say, well, then maybe that's the difference between normal people and Zenith and what we should maybe call the Zenith cluster of people. Maybe we're just, we are normal people's half brothers and sisters. We share some things in common with them. We look like them. But we're a little bizarre. You know, maybe a lot bizarre. I don't know. Sometimes I get accused of being really intensely bizarre. And that's where that comes from. Anyway, so, I find the more I talk about Navigium in my podcast, the better I feel about it, and the more inspired I am, that there are deeper truths here that are coming out through this. Like, I never really gave much thought to the whole idea of being complacent, of being conforming, and how powerful that is in the culture that we live in. And that a lot of the, I don't know if it's a lot of it, but it's bizarre behavior. A lot of the disability comes from trying to stick a, use a Men in Black thing. Trying to fit a bug into an Edgar suit. You know, it just, the fit's not good. It's really obvious that he's a weird-looking guy, and things just don't hang right. And I think that's the first tip-off, you know. And then we go into the things about, well, this is a disorder. This keeps him from functioning in society. This keeps him from being successful in job, employment, whatever. And we start hanging disorder labels on it, you know. It's a syndrome. It's a thing like that, where I'm just saying, no, it's a state of being that is analogous. Now, this is a hard thing for a lot of people to grasp because they figure everybody's basically normal, and you go, no. Let's say there was actually two groups, but they were both normal within their own sphere, you know. But we have two groups, and we're starting to find how much different they are. As the culture around us becomes more demanding of conforming to it, which I think is what's really happening these days, you know, people say, oh, we're free, we can do so many more interesting things now than we could ever do before. So many things are more accepted now. And you go, no, actually what it is, our culture, even more than it ever has before, demands conformity. You must, you know, you must follow behind the leader. You know, you must wear the American flag lapel pin, or you are evil. You know, those things like that. We have become much more strident. Not okay. Now we have a tricky topic. The predominant culture has become much more strident about we want everybody to conform more. You know, it sounds weird from the very thing where it's like, well, we don't have the straitjackets we used to have, you know. Gays are okay. You know, I don't believe that. Anyway, women wearing pants, that's okay. And you go, but those aren't questions of conformity, really. They are questions of what kind of behavior is okay. Although you can make the acceptable behavior pool larger, which we have, and I think that kind of masks the fact that we're becoming much more rigid in behavior, you know. There's so much behavior now that you don't do anymore. We don't see that anymore. You don't do. I need to come up with some examples for a future podcast. But you know, we become much more that way, much more rigid in what's okay. You know, in the past, it used to be okay that you'd have dissenters from a war. You know, that was expected. Now, it's much more unacceptable to have that. You know, if anybody speaks against the war in Iraq, they're not patriotic. Where in the past, you wouldn't say that. You'd say, well, we have a difference of opinion. You know, now it's like, oh, you're un-American. You're a dog. You're slime. And it's like, golly, we didn't used to call people this. We look back on the 60s, and even though many people now look back at the time of the 60s, and we could never do that again because our culture has become very compliant to what our cultural leaders tell us, you know. Even though we have kept up with the free love stuff, kept up with the whole, you can do pretty much whatever you want, and we've come up with ways to make sure that you don't have to face consequences for having done it, you know. There's expressing your sexuality any way you like seems to be very appropriate these days. In fact, this is the accepted way of showing that you're different. But it's really the only way you can show that you're different now, or one of the few. It's actually closed down to how many ways you can do it, although you might feel rather free in doing that. It's sick, though, because that's a sick channel to go down. I'm different, therefore I'm gay, therefore I'm just going to embrace gayness. That's why I think most really stridently gay people, ones that do it as a lifestyle for most of their lives, that it is, I think, a perversion of zenith, because it does somewhat become an obsession. I've noticed that. Gay people don't have, you know, there are no gay Baptists particularly. There are gays who want to break into the Baptist church, for instance. That's true of the Mormons too, and I think of anyone, the Catholics too. Trying to get them to be more accommodating of their interesting sexual behavior and trying to say that this is acceptable and good and everything's wonderful. But you have to understand, in doing that, haven't they been more striving to make you conform more to their way of thinking? I always thought that was kind of weird, but now as I think about it, it makes a whole lot more sense. You know, you would think that like gay people, for instance, who had to work so hard to be accepted for what they wanted to do, that you think they would be more accommodating of all kinds of different things, you know. They would be more of like kind of what I am, which is a live and let live sort of a person, you know. As long as they let me be gay, I'll surely let them let other people be bigoted jerks, because I'm just going to be a live and let live person. As long as they give me my space, I'll give them theirs. But you don't see that. That doesn't happen. We have become so much more of an anti type of thing. You know, people speak more of pendulum swings. You know, the culture used to be really against gays, and you go, not terribly, it was just something that you kind of ignored and you didn't really talk about. Well, now that being gay is acceptable, being bigoted against gays is the worst crime in the whole world. In fact, we have codified hate crimes. And it's mostly about saying, we're not just going to be live and let live. We have to destroy people who don't accept us. And it's like, wow, that is a serious conformance issue. You know, back in the past, I mean, you didn't want to come out of the closet back then. But now, when somebody comes out of the closet, they expect you to throw a party. And if you don't, well, they're going to be coming with tasers and stuff to come and punish you for not being more excited about them, you know, being deviant. And I know it sounds kind of weird. It's almost when I talked about we have been using our freedom to destroy our liberty. We have also been exercising more freedom in trying to compel everyone to be a certain way. We just want to have the power to say what that way will be. Like gays say, well, we are going to compel you to be more accommodating gays. We don't want to just, you know, be just left alone to our own device, and we can go to our own places and be gay there, and that's okay with us. No, it's got to be better than that. We require to be openly gay wherever we go, and that other people have to not just acknowledge us, but love us and embrace us, and say that we're these wonderful people. And there is no room for people to go, hey, you know, if you want to be gay, whatever, which is me. I'm kind of a, you know what, I don't think gay is good. I said, but you know what? You have your freedom to choose. You can do what you want. But please don't do it around me. And don't you dare start preaching your crap to my children. And that really offends them a lot. They demand that right that they can affect your child. You know, we need to make sure we have books in the schools. Maybe that's why I'm so anal about gay people. And sometimes I have to get rid of podcast episodes because they're just too nasty to toward gays, and it's because of this larger issue. It isn't just that they're gay. I mean, I don't like that, but I mean stridently, militantly going out and saying, you must acknowledge that I'm gay. I'm going to walk around with a shirt on that says I'm gay and you better like it. You know what it's like? What if I don't? And you go, well, then you're going to go to jail for hating me, for oppressing me. And you go, I'm not oppressing you. You can do whatever you want. Just don't do it near me. Oh, no, that's not good enough. So, you know, it's kind of like that. It's this weird thing about, yes, I guess we technically have more freedom as long as we embrace certain accepted deviancies, I guess, is probably the way to do it. I think we have actually become more constrained in what's going to be tolerated. I think we used to be a more tolerant culture. Not we, guy. Come on, Jay. Like trying to act the zenith. The larger culture has become more less tolerant, more intolerant to certain views. And one of those views is, by golly, everybody's going to be the same. At some point in the past, you know, I guess it was the rainbow type of thing, the little pictures used to have of all the little kids with different colors and from different cultures joining hands and singing kumbaya or whatever, you know, and we really got weird about that, to the point to where if you try to act like a white person or behave like a white person, you're hated and persecuted for being white. You know, and it's like, whoa, wait a minute, whatever happened? We're the majority group here. How come we're not accepted? And you go, because it's one of those things. We gave freedom to everybody else, but we just didn't give freedom. We gave them a license to control what would be tolerated. And it came back and it said, we are going to punish white people for being white, for doing what white people do. Now, I don't know that means you're being bigoted and stuff like that, but that's fine. Everybody's bigoted in some way. It's just whether it's acceptable, whether it's tolerated. Black people can be as bigoted towards anybody as they want to be. Really, 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 honestly, they can. They can say whatever they want because they've been so picked on in the past that they can get away with it. Boy, but if a white person says anything derogatory about black people, oh, man, hang him from the highest gallows. You know, he's an evil, nasty, rotten sucker, and he needs to die. You know, and I'm not trying to defend either side particularly, but just to say we're in our thing to give more people freedom to be more diverse, we've also become less tolerant of other things. And when you hit a group that has really been hit on for a toleration problem, autistic people have really been hit bad with saying, we aren't going to tolerate your behavior. Your behavior is repugnant to us, and we're going to steer everything toward getting rid of your behavior. You know, schools, that's what the whole school program in relation to autism is all about. It's all about getting rid of the behaviors they don't like to see. If you flick your hands in front of your face, they're doing their darndest to get you to stop doing that, because that's just intolerable. We just can't have that kind of behavior. And even though they might be all sweet about, honey, you need to, you need to stop doing that. That's not going to help you in life. It's still some acts of just being intolerant. Well, anyway, this is Jay Numero. I've reached my destination. I'm having a good day. And that was a little bit about Navigium. We'll do more later. Talk to you later. This is Jay. Bye.